You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 25th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Astra Taylor and Elizabeth Alvarez from the Debt Collective on the 100-day Biden Debt Jubilee. Meanwhile, Republicans build a wall against COVID relief. The CDC director admits we have no idea how much coronavirus vaccine is in the United States. Joe Biden to impose a South African travel ban as reports show Moderna's vaccine less effective in fighting that particular strain. Still effective, just a little bit less. Chuck Schumer agrees to a two-week delay of Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. Meanwhile, new reports on just how many attempts Trump made to overthrow the election, including ousting acting attorney general. New report shows that U.S. intelligence is getting your smartphone data, and they're doing so by skirting around the need for warrants by simply buying it. Gavin Newsom to lift the stay-at-home orders in California. Chicago teachers stage a labor action and defy Chicago's reopening plan. Russian police detained thousands of people in rallies, or from rallies, I should say, across the country in a pro-Alexei Navalny protest. And lastly, Mar-a-Lago members are quitting the golf club because it's gotten a lot sadder since Donald Trump came back to live there. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. It is Monday. We are all back in studio, of course, COVID-safe studio. Oh, I am sitting across the studio with screens and protectors and filters all running from Emma Vigeland, which, of course, Emma, you don't take that personally, I hope.
No, I don't. I mean, I could. You could be claiming I'm some sort of diseased human being, but we also have a window open. You forgot about that other precaution.
We have a window open as well. We are just we're playing it safe here always. We should tell you, I mean, we get regular tests and whatnot, but we still maintain this screening and this and that, particularly with the idea that the new mutation of the virus, the British one, is probably going to supposedly be dominant within 6 to 8 weeks in this country. And new reports out today about the South African strain, which apparently makes the Moderna vaccination somewhat less effective. However, it starts at 90-95%, so somewhat less effective, apparently, according to the scientists at this point, to the extent that they know, is still pretty effective. And they're talking about maybe testing out a third dosage of the vaccine. But the real problem in this country, of course, is that there's been no infrastructure built to distribute vaccines or produce vaccines. And the Biden administration, that is their job number one.
100 shots in 100 days is the promise. Some people are saying that that is too low of a bar. You're not going to hear me be soft on the Biden administration because that's not my job. But they were left zero infrastructure, an empty cupboard, if you will, from the Trump administration. And it seems like it might be a little difficult to build from scratch at this point, which is kind of what they're tasked to do.
I think so. I think also part of it is just simply to what extent there is a willingness to cut into the profits. Pfizer's going to be making billions of dollars of profits off this. All of the other entities that could be producing one, I mean, you could go to Johnson & Johnson and say, we know you're close to developing a vaccine, but however, stop, or at least be prepared to be backed up, because we want your facilities to be producing the Pfizer vaccine. There is a story, too, about the AstraZeneca vaccine, and that there was an attempt to make it open source. I'm still reading into this, but they were convinced not to for perhaps, I don't know what reasons. And there's a very tough time getting this this vaccine distributed. Poorer countries are not getting the vaccinations. And of course, the problem here is that, aside from the sort of moral issues involved in it, but strictly from a public and world health perspective, the more you allow the coronavirus to develop and travel through different corners of the planet without any type of mitigation that a vaccine brings, the more opportunity there is for the virus to mutate and develop in such a way that the vaccinations do not protect us from it. So there is both a moral and just a sheer public policy reason why you want to make sure that the vaccine is widely distributed and available, regardless of where you live. And
I mean, there's the point you make about how they could compel these other manufacturers to produce either the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine is a very good one. But this does not seem like the administration that's going to cut into pharma's profits.
The Defense Production Act will cut into some measure of profits in and of itself, because you're instructing them to do something that they haven't already done, and they usually just pursue
profits. And you could
target
smaller fish and ask those, not Johnson & Johnson, who's in the process of developing its own vaccine, hey, we need these facilities, for example.
I would just go for the biggest fish myself.
I would, too.
Fair enough. All right, let's talk a little bit about the COVID relief. We have talked over the past couple of weeks, really, about the two tracks that are available to the Biden administration to do this. Actually, there's essentially two tracks, but there's variations of these two tracks. One is try and get it through the Senate under three tracks. One is try and get it through the Senate with 10 votes, at least, from Republicans to clear the possible filibuster threshold. The other track, which is, I guess, a similar track in some respect, I don't even know how to characterize these tracks. The other potential tactic is to get rid of the filibuster and make it about 50 Democrats in the Senate plus Kamala Harris as the tie-breaking vote. The third mechanism is reconciliation. Reconciliation can only deal with things that directly implicate the U.S. budget, but that's a lot of things. Here is Bernie Sanders on with Dana Bash on CNN State of the Union. And he makes a very good point that sometimes context makes a difference. And the purpose in which you use certain tools is relevant as to whether it justifies using certain tools. Here is that clip.
Republicans have used the so-called reconciliation process before, like in 2017, to try to kill Obamacare. You accused them of abusing the process back then. You said, quote, the function of reconciliation is to adjust federal spending and revenue, not to enact major changes in policy. But you alluded to this. You are the chairman of the budget committee, or going to be. You are already talking about using this tactic for things like paid family and medical leave, for universal pre-K and childcare, for climate change, tuition-free college, eliminating student debt, and the $15 minimum wage. How is that not what you criticize Republicans for doing?
Well, the devil is in the details of what we want to do and when we want to do it and when we have to do it. What we are talking about, by the way, are two separate reconciliation packages. Number one, the emergency one right now.
Right.
Get direct checks. Get those checks into people's pockets right now so they can feed their families. And make sure that people are not evicted from their homes. Make sure that states have the funds they need to get vaccines into people's arms. That's what we've got to do right now. And then as soon as that is done, we have to rebuild this economy. Unemployment is much, much too high. Wages are much, much too low. There are structural problems that we have had, we have ignored for years. Climate change is a reality.
And you're okay doing all of that through this process that you criticize Republicans for using? These are major policy changes.
These are major policy changes, but the devil is in the details. And I criticize Republicans, for using reconciliation to give tax breaks to billionaires, to create a situation where large profitable corporations now pay zero in federal income taxes. Yes, I did criticize them for that. And if they want to criticize me for helping to feed children who are hungry, or senior citizens in this country who are isolated and alone and don't have enough food, they can criticize me. I think it's the appropriate step forward.
Well, the devil isn't even in the details. The devil is in
the top line, the top line of all of it.
Right.
I mean, really is what he's saying. It's just the context. It's that reconciliation. I mean, I could even go deeper into the fact of the matter is that the 50 senators, in the event that they go through reconciliation, the 50 senators who vote on this reconciliation bill would represent far more people than were at 50 Republican
people.
Yes. I mean, aside from that, I mean, because presumably, right, the reconciliation is, it's rather undemocratic to use it to pass measures that benefit a very small segment of the population.
Absolutely.
That's really the issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I understand the role of asking that kind of question, but I mean, I even think Dana Bash knows that it is false in its outset. I mean, like, there's not a way to conflate in good faith using reconciliation to give massive tax breaks and using reconciliation to provide relief for people in a time of massive crisis. I mean, Bernie Sanders' position on the filibuster, I don't know if it's changed, but he's still consistent here. I don't think he seems like he still is on board with filibuster reform, but not abolishing it altogether. I don't agree with him on that. But to say that there's inconsistency in his position here, I just think it's false.
Well, it's
framing.
The fascinating thing is that whenever Sanders, I shouldn't say whenever, but very often, you see Sanders critiques on these process things or on his approach, never a direct frontal investigation of what he's fighting for.
Exactly.
Because it would sound ludicrous to the American public if Dana Bash or any commentator on the news went at him and actually said, well, wait a second, the merits of daycare. You know, why would we want that? Or $15 minimum wage when we know that if we'd been keeping up with productivity, the wage would be at somewhere around $23, $24. I mean, or the whole litany of things that that he was discussing. Like, you could do that. You could interrogate the relative merit of that in the same way that you would interrogate the relative merit of, should we really have tax cuts for billionaires? Should we really zero out corporate taxes?
It's a procedural critique as opposed to a policy critique, which they very rarely engage with him on. It's always, let's see if we can call you out as a procedural hypocrite, because the moral stance that he is on is just like indisputable.
It's really fundamentally a question of how you define what benefit to society is.
Yeah, and again, it's just the fetishization of compromise and bipartisanship for compromise and bipartisanship's sake in the media. That's what frustrates me so much. But that's what's latent in her question to him.
All right, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll be talking to Astra Taylor and Elizabeth Alvarez on the Biden Jubilee 100 campaign. We'll be right back in just a moment. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can join the Majority Report and support the free show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of ads, and you support the free show, and you get extra content just about every single gosh darn day. Also, check out AM Quickie, amquickie.com. It's 7 minutes of headline news, quick bingo bango in the morning. By the time you wake up, unless you're like, I don't know, going fishing and you're getting out at like,
five
I guess now
morning.
It'd be like ice fishing.
Yeah. That sounds really pleasurable, by the way.
Well, and if you do go out ice fishing, just if you're going somewhere where there's connectivity, you can download it or listen to it when it comes online around 7:30 or something like that. So good luck with the fishing. But assuming you're not, it's going to be there when you wake up. AmQuickie.com, it's completely free. You can find it on your podcast server or go to AmQuickie.com. Or it's on the app, the Majority app, at MajorityApp.com, which is also a free app. Okay, I want to welcome back to the program Astra Taylor, and welcome to the program for the first time, Elizabeth Alvarez. Elizabeth is a student debt organizer, policy student for the Debt Collective. Astra, Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello.
Hi. All right, Astra, let's start with you. Just tell me the history of the Debt Collective and sort of this, when this movement started gaining some traction.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on. This is exciting. The Debt Collective is a union for debtors that has its roots in the Occupy Wall Street movement. During those days of Occupy, I just realized it's the 10th year anniversary this year, 2021, time flies. We actually organized something called 1T Day, a protest marking the day student debt surpassed $1 trillion. So now student debt stands at $1.7 trillion. If something doesn't happen, we're going to be protesting 2T Day under a Biden administration. So the idea is that our debts are somebody else's assets. They're a form of leverage. So we invite debtors to come together, just like workers come together in a labor union, to demand cancellation and to demand the provision of public services. So in this case, free college for all. Just, you know, what we had generations ago in this country, public quality education for those who want it, so that we don't have student debt, you know, destroying lives. 45 million debtors, and it's you know, causing incredible stress of mind and body. People can't plan for their futures. They can't plan for retirement. Seniors are getting their Social Security garnished. I mean, it's a crisis, and partly why the crisis is recognized now is because the Debt Collective has been pushing this issue since those days in Zuccotti Park.
So Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about your story, because in many respects it's typical of I guess hundreds of thousands of people, millions across the country in many respects.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Sam. So my story starts at St. John's University. I come from an immigrant background. My family migrated to this country in the mid-90s. And like many Americans, I was told, you know, go to school. Everything will be okay. As some people might know, St. John's University's tuition is very, very high. And I signed on these loans, and now I'm about $80,000 into student debt. There I studied political science because, of course, I too wanted to have an impact on, you know, like the shaping of our country, etc. But unfortunately, I've been unsettled by this debt.
How much of that is principal at this point? I mean, and how much of it is sort of just accruing, you know, interest?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I originally borrowed $40,000, and now it's not doubled. I double checked my interest rates as I've been organizing with the debt collective, and my highest interest loan is 11%.
Are you? Well, let me just ask you this question. You're not like 80 years old, are you? I mean, like, no, but it's like that is stunning amount of interest. And we should say, like, I mean, you strike me as someone who's fairly young. I mean, most people do now at my age, but I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of money to have accumulated. How if you don't mind me asking, how long have you been out of college?
5 years.
That's nuts. I mean, I'm sorry. That's just absolutely nuts. Who owns your loan? Like, who is making all of this money off of you to presumably go to a university, become a better citizen? I like to think that universities are doing that. I mean, who owns all that? Who's going to get all that profit from you?
Yeah, so my servicer is Nelnet. They're one of the many servicers, including Sally Mae, et cetera. Yeah.
Well, servicer, but I mean, who loaned you the money?
Oh, the American government. These are all federal loans.
This is such an important point. The vast majority, over 95% of student debt, is held by the federal government. The federal government makes an enormous profit off of lending to students, and it's completely unnecessary. That's not what the government's for. That's not what the state is for. However, that gives student debt its power, and this is why the debt collective focuses on it. Because all of this debt is owned by the federal government can get rid of it. In fact, the debt collective is demanding that Joe Biden cancel all student debt using the authority he already has. It's called Compromise and Settlement Authority. It was granted by Congress to the Department of Education, to the executive branch back in 1965. The ability to create debt implies the ability to cancel it. And so this is one of the things that the Biden administration can solve right away without going through Congress, without dealing with Mitch McConnell and the obstructionist Republicans. And so it's a policy choice actually to perpetuate this harm. And you're so right to point out how impossible this math is for people. This is not a rare story.
This is like we're all implicated in this. We're all basically, you know, a bunch of payday lenders. I mean, honestly, this like the idea that that debt has doubled in the years that you would have graduated. And I want to get back, and I just want to just add to what you were saying, Astra, is that the authority that Joe Biden exercised on day one when he continued the moratorium on collecting interest through COVID is exactly the same authority that we could go in on a Word doc, change a couple of the words, his signature would be just as valid. But I want to go back a little bit and talk a little bit about the 2015 student debt strike, Astra. Just get a sense of how this has developed, because I think it's difficult for people my age and older to sort of fully appreciate how things have changed dramatically in terms of the cost of a college education, 2 or 4 year education, and also I think like the availability of outright grants and whatnot for people. I think it's just very hard for some of the olds like myself to appreciate what younger people are facing.
This is part of why it's so frustrating, I think, when older people say, oh, I can't believe young people want their loans canceled. It's like, well, I can't believe you got to go to college for free or basically you nothing. And there is a brilliant...
I don't mean to interrupt you, but will you please just remind people, like, when we say for free, like, that's not... This is not rhetoric. Like, literally 50 years ago, I mean, I'm not that old, when you went to college, there were plenty of opportunities to go for basically nothing.
Exactly that, you know, or you could pay your tuition even at a private university with a part-time job that was paying minimum wage. So things have changed. And in fact, it was a political shift that many people, many historians credit to Ronald Reagan, who wanted to attack the University of California public education system, which promised quality education, whether it's community colleges, state colleges, or universities like Berkeley for free to its citizenry. So there was a right-wing counterattack that was driven by racism and driven by business interests to say, let's not let's not have college be a right. Let's have it be a commodity. And let's use student debt actually as a way to quiet down the students who were then engaged in social protests, as we know. So what that did was created a student loan system with very perverse incentives and created the student debt crisis as we know it. What the Debt Collective did in 2015 was to begin organizing with a group of students who had attended a predatory for-profit college chain called Corinthian Colleges. For-profit colleges get federal money and then charge students huge sums to go for vocational degrees that are usually worthless. And Corinthian served hundreds of thousands of students a year. So these are massive institutions that attract mostly Black and brown, working class, immigrant, veteran, first generation students, students who are vulnerable and poor to begin with, and then give them this incredible student debt with no opportunity at the end. And it's very important to note that the student loan system is the same, whether you're going to University of Phoenix or Harvard, right? The back end, the money is it all, you follow the chains of it straight to the federal government. Long story short, 15 students calling themselves the Corinthian 15 went on a debt strike. We made a lot of noise about this. Their numbers swelled to the hundreds, then the thousands. The Debt Collective organized a very creative legal strategy. We ended up winning over $1 billion of debt cancellation from the federal government for these students, changes to federal law. And we got the idea that mass student debt cancellation is out there. And that led to the research through one of our co-founders, Luke Caron, the research on compromise and settlement. So we actually had a letter ready to go to Hillary Clinton when we thought she might be the president, saying, cancel student debt, exactly right, with the signature, let's get rid of this problem. So that campaign has led to what we are doing now, which is the Biden Jubilee 100, 100 student debt strikers from all walks of life, all different educational backgrounds that Elizabeth is part of, that are saying we demand full student debt cancellation within Biden's 100 days. That's what the 100 symbolically represent. So we are saying that people who are struggling under the weight of these loans shouldn't feel ashamed. They shouldn't default in silence. They should say, we can't pay these loans. We can't beat this game of the compound interest. And we won't pay because we shouldn't have to pay, because education should be a right.
And just to speak kind of the language of the politicians in D.C. who are a lot more concerned with economic growth, in my view, than kind of providing relief for people. Can you touch on what this would mean for the economy? Because my generation, you know, Elizabeth, I would assume we're of the same generation. Home ownership for a lot of us is a fantasy, something like it's that's just out of reach because of the student debt that we've been saddled with as a generation, and people older than us as well. Can you talk about what that would do for other industries if student debt was canceled? Astra or Elizabeth, either one.
Which one of you wants to take that?
I mean, I'll just quickly say there's research that says that canceling all student debt would be $108 billion a year boost to the economy. Over 10 years, that's over $1 trillion. That would create over a million jobs a year. So certainly in COVID, we need this. But I think, I would throw this question to Elizabeth and say, what would you spend your money on if you weren't paying back the student debt?
Yeah, I'm currently pursuing a master's degree in policy precisely because I do want to have an impact in shaping these public matters, but obviously it would be amazing if I could pay for tuition out of pocket, right? I've also would have loved to again buy a home, right? And coming from New York City, that's actually something that's really, really impossible for everyone in my income tax bracket. Unfortunately, 5 years out of college, it would also mean that I could take on service work. I could work for the public sector like I wanted to. However, public sector salaries do not make it so that I'm able to pay my student loans the right way by the law.
I think the president of the, or maybe it's the former president now of the Home Builders Association, said this was like 2 or 3 years ago now, that the number one drag on new home ownership or building rather was student debt. Elizabeth, just talk a little bit more about this dynamic of what you would do. I mean, because this, I think, is sort of the hard thing to sort of qualitatively assess. What are we losing as a society in terms of quality people who are dedicated to all sorts of roles in society that don't pay enough money to pay off the debt? I mean, I don't know how we can quantify that, but that seems to me to be where it's almost like our own brain drain that we are inflicting upon ourselves.
Yeah, I think that one really great way to kind of like speak to it quantitatively first is just for context. Before I enrolled in my master's program, I was paying about $900 in student debt per month, both federal and private. And $900 was the average rent in the Bronx, maybe like 5 years ago or so. As you guys know, crowding in New York City households is a huge, huge deal, something that's affecting the COVID-19 pandemic, specifically in my particular zip code. So that's one way to qualify it, I guess. The second way is kind of like going back to like my personal history. I began my studies in journalism. I really wanted to be a journalist and write investigative reporting, very similar to how you do, Sam. When I graduated, I wasn't able to take on an offer for my first journalism job because the pay was $28,000, and I just simply couldn't afford that. So of course I went in and I worked for the public relations field where I was earning barely even a living wage at just under $45,000. Again, not a living wage. And imagine somebody paying $900 a month on a $45,000 salary. So qualitatively, that's kind of like speaking to how this impacts us.
And it's I mean, it is. When you start to sort of like absorb the implications of this, when that only people who are coming from wealth can go into journalism, only people who are coming from wealth can go into teaching, can go into social services. You start to get a sense of what it can do to a society and to sort of like and how it builds upon itself over time. All right. So let's do this, Astrid. I want to like just present to you some of the arguments that I have heard against this. Now, I should also say, I just want to add into this that I just saw a report from the American Association of University Women that Black women are the highest have the highest student debt across the board. So they have 56% more than white men, which I would imagine is a function of at least two things I can think of off the top of my head. One is obviously the earnings power of men when they graduate is greater, and even if they don't, presumably is greater than women and particularly women of color, and so they have the ability to pay it off, so that they're not going to have double the interest, the amount that they had to pay off 5 years after college. And the other is, I think, when we talk about these for-profit universities, they're a big, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, their business plan is to target women of color who are not able to move through the job force and perceive that they need a college degree to get to the next level in their careers. And so they are often taken into these things. And one of these things these companies do, and I should say, you know, we interviewed Tressie McMillan Cotton about this. I think it was maybe 2 years to the day, actually, back in January of 19. They don't provide you data. I'm like, hey, this is what your return on investment is. People just presume, and you know, understandably so. All right, but give us a sense of like, how is this fair, Astra? Like, what do you say to the person who says like, well, I foregoed, you know, vacations and I paid it off, or I paid off my debt, or this is only like a gift to, you know, wealthy people who can go to college. What do you say to that?
Oh, I have some stuff to say to that because I do hear it a lot. First, I do want to say on your for-profit point, I would invite people to watch a film that is just up at the Intercept website, You Are Not Alone, that I made that has a lot of stories about this and the Corinthian strike. It just went up today. So we hear this now. In fact, Betsy DeVos wrote a farewell letter. Farewell, Betsy. And what she said was, don't listen to those people demanding full debt cancellation because it will be a handout to the wealthy. So it was a very funny thing for Betsy to say. This is a talking point these days that full student debt cancellation is regressive. It's not true. Student debt is regressive because the children of billionaires and the children of millionaires don't have to borrow money. to attend college, right? So already you've only got certain classes of people borrowing to go to school. And as you say, the burden falls most heavily on Black women. They hold the most student debt because of a lack of intergenerational wealth and exactly wage discrimination and the existence of for-profit colleges. So there is research by lots of great economists. Derek Hamilton comes to mind, saying you want to have the maximum impact in terms of closing the racial wealth gap, cancel all the student debt. You want to have the most equity, cancel all the student debt. So this is something, you know, the research is pretty clear, but it's a popular talking point. I paid off my student loans. And the fact is, you know, I'm excited for people like Elizabeth and the rest of the Biden Jubilee 100 to be freed from these debts. Just because I had to pay, I don't believe that other people should have to suffer under this. I think we will benefit as a society and as a democracy from a more fair system. The line I also often hear, which you got at very well, Sam, is what if some doctors or some lawyers get their loans canceled? You know, assuming that these are well-paid people selfishly pursuing their own ends. What you've illustrated is that many of them would go to public service. We know, for example, that there's a shortage of dentists in rural areas because people graduate from dentistry school with so much debt, they have to work in highly populated cities to pay those loans back. So we're all suffering and we'd all benefit from full cancellation. We'd have this economic boost. People would spend money in their communities. People could pursue public interest careers. It's a win-win for everyone. And Joe Biden can do it this afternoon.
Well, you mentioned dentistry, and I thought about doctors and lawyers as well, and them being predominantly, probably, I'm sure the data bears this out, coming from wealthy backgrounds, and the trickle down that effect has, right? So we have a lot of medical racism in this country. That could be an effect of the fact that a lot of people from wealthy families go into pursuing being a doctor, and other people might be discouraged because they just don't have the means to pursue those kinds of careers, and lawyers as well. And can you talk about some of those effects in cultures of professions where they have to pursue degrees that are so out of people's price ranges that they wouldn't even consider it altogether, either of you?
Yeah, in fact, one of the Biden Jubilee 100 strikers is a doctor in Miami, Armin Henderson. He's part of the Dream Defenders, which is a great racial justice group in Florida. And his point is exactly what you're saying. He's saying, I come from a poor household, and he owes $600,000 of student loans for his medical degree. He wants to serve people as a physician. But again, this debt often drives people to specialize in certain types of medicine where they'll be higher paid instead of doing the work they want to do with the people who most need equitable healthcare. So yeah. Again, it's these perverse incentives that wind up happening. And for Armin, I know I can speak confidently that this is an equity issue. This is one of the reasons that our medical system is so discriminatory and unfair. But $600,000, he'll never pay it off.
Let's talk a little bit about let me ask both this. So Elizabeth, your debt now is twice the amount of money that you borrowed, and like I say, in 5 years, I just find that just absolutely stunning. And do we have a sense of how much of that $1.7 trillion is just the profit that the U.S. government is going to be making on this?
I've never seen that written. I've never seen that broken down, but that's a brilliant point that we should get the research on that.
Absolutely.
The point is also that $1.7 trillion, again, as I said, it was $1 trillion on one T-Day in 2011. So we are racing towards $2 trillion rapidly. So we get a sense of it in that scale of growth.
All right, let's talk about the other aspect of this, which I think is really important. It's that you don't want to, close the barn door, as it were. When we talk about the opportunity for an option for free university in every state. And let's be very clear about this, because I've actually interviewed some people who were, I can't remember this specific instance, but people assumed it would be ridiculous to have the U.S. government, pay for Harvard University's tuition for everybody. That's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking, when we say free college, we're saying everyone has the opportunity to go to a university, presumably in each state, that is free. that you have the opportunity to go there. You don't, you can go to other private institutions. You want to pay more, right? But I mean, if that's what we're talking about, yes.
Yeah. Elizabeth, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what a difference that would make for your generation.
Yeah. Yeah. I can actually speak to the instance of New York City, my home state. New York did try to enact a free college for all, very popular to, or rather very similar to other schemes that have been implemented in other states. However, it does bar like earnings at $150,000, et cetera. But the research has shown that only about 3% of folks have been able to enroll in that. And it does come saddled with a bunch of different caveats around having to like live in the state and like work in the state for 5 years plus. So even like the current schemes that our policy interventions meant to address this are still not comprehensive enough as would be just free college for all. I know several people who have left the country because they're unable to pay their student loans. And I know people that have dropped out of school because they're unable to pay for school. And that's a reality for a lot of Black and Latino folks. So
in that situation, what happens is you accrue a certain amount of debt. You can't go all the way in college because you can't afford anymore. But then you go back out into the job market and your opportunities are limited because you haven't gotten a graduate degree. And so that number, you know, grows and grows. Well, let me ask you this. How problematic would it have been, Elizabeth, if you were forced to have gone to, if you had the opportunity to go to a free university in New York State and there was a couple of billionaire kids in your class? I mean, like, do we really think as a society that would be a bad thing? That if our billionaire class or our multimillionaire class went to school with, you know, I guess the plebes would be a problem? I mean, isn't this like what? How could that be a bad thing in any situation? And the amount of benefit our society would get from that seems to be exponential. I mean, we paid for two billionaire kids to go to college.
Right. Actually, I think that's people often make that like false equivalence, right? That like if a really large amount of folks are benefiting from something and like a small amount of folks in this case would be benefiting from something that they're sort of so quote unquote not entitled to. Does the fact that like two billionaires kids going to school for free, does that outweigh the fact that several million kids who aren't able to afford school, are we going to like not do that because it would just benefit two kids? I don't think that makes any sense. So I totally disagree with that.
Well, it's such a paper-thin excuse. I mean, it reminds me of Mitch McConnell, who was just arguing against relief payments on the Senate floor, saying this is only going to benefit rich people. And then you look into it for 1 second and it's no, this would broadly benefit people who couldn't afford college in this instance, obviously.
Exactly.
I think COVID makes this so much more important, though, because we also are facing a bigger crisis of universities at this moment. And what COVID showed among, you know, taught us a lot. But one thing is that the only sustainable source of revenue for our educational institutions, which are critical for society, is public funding, because, you know, students didn't want to enroll, so tuition went down. Universities were building all these big stadiums, hoping to get revenue through sports. They were building these fancy apartment, you know, dorm complexes, hoping to get revenue through that. And engaging in all these schemes when it's like, let's just do the simple thing. Let's fund public schools with public money. And yes, maybe we'll cut down on some of the bells and whistles, right, that these fancy colleges have. But, you know, I think the fact is that, you know, we focus too much on the Harvards, which, you know, serves a couple thousand students, instead of thinking about what it would be like to go back to the original vision that informed the California system in the middle of the 20th century, the CUNY system, which was built to be free for working class students. You know, we have a model, and that's why there's College for All legislation that was introduced. It's going to be reintroduced in a couple months that basically figures this out and would I think be a dramatic improvement for students from all walks of life and more sustainable and robust when a crisis hits.
And lastly, just so that we're sort of like, you know, covering all of the bases here. I have not seen, and I'm curious about the proposal that you're talking about. I have not seen a proposal for a free option of college in every state that does not include a similar parallel funding for vocational things, for vocational studies, as opposed to, liberal arts university. Is that right, Astra?
Well, the College for All bill makes public colleges 2- and 4-year institutions. So a lot of 2-year institutions are, you know, focused on associate degrees and more vocational. So I think what it does, though, is it allows people to go for that bigger 4-year degree if that's what they want. You know, College for All who want it, we could say it is. And I think that, you know, it's important that people have a vocational option, but what we've done, I think part of what student debt has done is it's forced us to think of education strictly in terms of job training, because what happens when you have so much student debt is all you need is that job at the end to pay back your debt. And so we are also robbing people of the ability to take that longer time to learn, to explore, to acquire those insights they might need to be, as you said, citizens in a democracy. So I think vocational training is important, should be subsidized too, but we should also give working people the opportunity to have 4 years to, to be students.
Lastly, Elizabeth, I want you to just give us a sense of like how big of an issue is this with your contemporaries? I mean, like, you know, how much does this dominate the conversation? And I mean, I would imagine on some level, like social lives, I mean, everything on some level, because you've got this sort of massive cloud hanging over you 24/7.
Yeah. I don't know a single person without student debt. Just from my social network, I don't know anyone. It is something that we talk about constantly because it impacts so many aspects of our lives, right? If we go back to the housing question, there are folks who are unable to pay for their living situation without getting their refunds from their loans. Students do depend fully on funding, like to go about their lives. So it's very big, and that's part of the reason why I got involved with the Debt Collective, because this issue does need to be organized broadly, as broadly as possible. Again, this issue is a lot bigger than the 2008 crisis.
So, Astra, if people want to get involved in the Biden Jubilee 100 campaign, what do they do? I mean, what are the different sort of levels of involvement? Can they be? Is it too late for you to go on debt strike? Tell us.
One thing we want to do is politicize non-payment. Before COVID, 1 million+ people were defaulting on their student loans every year. I defaulted back when I had student loans. We're trying to also say, don't do that ashamed and isolated. Join this political movement. So, you know, the fight is likely not going to end at the end of these 100 days. So go to debtcollective.org. Join the union. That's what we need, to have power in numbers, because our debts overwhelm us individually, but together we can overwhelm the system. So there's petitions to sign, there's calls to join. Obviously, we are organizing in a pandemic context, so a lot of stuff is virtual. So if people want to get involved in this, they can immediately go to debtcollective.org, and there's meetings throughout the week.
Astra Taylor, Elizabeth Alvarez, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it. It's just sort of stunning to me that people could be aware of this, know how easy it is for Joe Biden to do this, and like we don't even know, like just wave off this $1.7 trillion that's supposedly amortized at least like 30-40 years out anyways. A huge percentage of that is interest, and we could just rid our society of this problem like with a stroke of a pen. It just seems stunning to me. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap things up. We're back. I just, you know,
it was great.
Well, it's just, there's so much, it's so easy to deal with this problem. and to move forward with it. It's inexplicable. There is a bill, right, that Schumer and Warren have introduced or plan to introduce to relieve $50,000 debt per person. But you listen to someone like Elizabeth and you're like, you didn't even borrow $50,000. You borrowed $40,000 and you owe $80,000 5 years out. That's just, it's.
Yeah. And then College for All, the proposal that Bernie Sanders put forward, and this is off the top of my head, but it was just such a small amount of money. I think it's like $72 billion. I could be wrong. Matt or Brendan, if you don't mind looking that up just to fact check me. But it's a common sense problem. And I think a huge part of the issue is one that, like, obviously banks get enriched by a lot of these student loans. The federal government gets enriched by this. And then also just that members of Congress and people in power are removed from this being a reality. They're just not, they don't deal with it as wealthy people.
I think there's also I don't want to say non-rational one, although I would say that all of these arguments are non-rational. But it's two-part. I think there is a concern that there's a puritanical, I think, sort of value system about, you know, the moral hazard that we're creating if we let people think that they can get away with without repaying their debts. I mean, at least in the narrow context of universities, you wouldn't have the need for this type of debt if you added a College for All type of situation. But the other is that, like, look, we see debt discharged all the time for corporations, for individuals in the context of bankruptcy court. Our society has a long, I mean, endless, predates the Americans project of debt relief. And the idea that it is a moral hazard only when it applies to people not wealthy enough to pay for college is...
It's ludicrous.
It's ludicrous. It's perverse.
It's $48, Brendan just sent, per year to eliminate tuition fees for four-year public colleges and universities. I think there's a higher end that's, like, estimate that's $72 billion, but that's right. I mean, like it's that's nothing for the federal government. Nothing.
Nothing.
And Grabe would point out that it's about control, right? I mean, I think that's exactly why. I mean, Nancy McClain ruffled so many feathers because she suggested that this was a response to, like, the Angela Davis and the 70s campus activism, that we need to have these kids start paying for this and, you know, have to go into corporate jobs afterwards and that sort of thing. And I think that rings really true. And the more that we just don't do the obvious here, I think that's what it's about. It's about control.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think you can make the same argument about healthcare as well, right? I mean, there was a time 10, 15 years ago where you would hear nothing, but every car that rolls off the line for GM, $3,200 of it is healthcare. Well, then why wouldn't you have an outcry from businesses to say, like, we're going to offload this expense onto the federal government? Yes, we'll pay marginally more in taxes, but we don't need to have a side business of, you know, in human resources trying to figure out how we're going to do health insurance. And I think a big part of it is simply it's a function of control. If you are in college you're basically building this massive, I mean, I just can't even imagine the, you know, 5 years out of college, having an $80,000 bill, and you know, like, you're just looking around your apartment, and it's like, wait, where's the expensive painting that I bought? The 75-foot television,
Sam,
that I bought for what?
It's the avocado toast that the millennials keep buying. That's why they're not buying homes. And I've had conversations with people, by the way, who say, like, I had to pay off my student loan debt. Why shouldn't everybody else? Like, there is a legitimate, you know, old school kind of thinking in that way, which is beyond comprehension to me, but some people really feel that way.
I wonder if they would apply that same logic to, say, I don't know, the COVID vaccine, that because no one was protected by the COVID vaccine last year and people passed away, that no one in the future should have COVID vaccine either. I mean, the
people died of cancer. Listen, maybe you should die of cancer too.
The fact of the matter is,
we shouldn't improve things.
I imagine in specific instances, it's not the case. But broadly speaking, as a society, we had this in the 50s, in the 60s, 40s, into the 70s. No cost, or extremely low cost, negligible cost, universities, and quality universities. And it is a benefit to society, broadly speaking. And in terms of fairness, obviously, it was unfair that that was available 30, 50 years ago, and it's not available today. So that stuff, I think people should understand when they hear those complaints. They are complaints that are either A, not terribly well thought out or researched or contextualized, or B, disingenuous. But as a society only, if you merely believe in the idea that our job is only to provide opportunity, people must understand as a society, which I think doesn't go far enough, but I understand that people just feel that that should be the function. When you are making university or higher education in any form prohibitively expensive, you are curtailing the opportunity of millions upon millions of your fellow Americans. And Joe Biden can fix this in the amount of time it takes me to pour a cup of coffee. They know the language. They know he can do it, and he can do it. So check that out. We'll put a link to that on the post today at majority.fm. We will be back with more tomorrow. Emma, we'll see you then. I lied. I'm going to see you now. I see you.
Yeah, I know.
We're still here.
It's the daily lie that we all agree to.
That's right.
That the show ends.
That the show ends at that point. Well, I mean, it does. Well, we really have three iterations of the show.
Yeah.
We have the show that they just rerun on the Peacock channel.
Mm-hmm. That's the Charmander, if you will.
The what?
It's a Pokemon thing.
Oh, my God.
It's a Pokemon metaphor.
That's the first evolution.
The Charmander. And then the second evolution is...
Charmeleon.
Oh, my Lord, Charmeleon. And then, of course, we have the fun half, which is the...
Charizard.
Is there anything else?
No.
That kind of works for Charizard.
Pretty good.
I hate that that's off the top of my head.
You're going to have to, like, prime me of that, because I'm going to freak Saul out today. And I come back, and I'm like, dude.
It's my favorite Pokemon, I think.
Like, you got to teach me, like, some way in which I can work that into conversation with him. I'm just like, wow, what's going on with Charmeleon today?
Yeah, he's like the lizard. I don't know if he's a little orange lizard, and then he grows into, like, a big dragon, pretty much. Pretty sick.
Folks, just a reminder, if you want the full lowdown on what's going on with Pokemon, become a member of the show today. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You join us in the fun half day. Things got a little crazy over the weekend with me and Twitter and with like the whole force the vote crowd. And then Jimmy Dore went and platformed a Boogaloo Boy, and then things.
No. The best part was that we covered that he platformed the Boogaloo Boy. Then he proudly tweeted out about the Boogaloo Boy.
We covered that he was praising a video of the Boogaloo Boy,
right?
And then he invited the guy onto his show.
Oh, so he yeah. So
and
he,
interviewed him, and then was like. You know, I mean, supposedly he did a we'll talk about this. He did a follow-up video where he was like, this is a gettable guy for us. Well, dude, then why are you tweeting out to your followers on how great the Boogaloo guys are?
Like, yeah.
It's a little bit sideways. But don't forget, check out Nomiki's show. It Tuesday through Friday. You can find it at 3 p.m. at youtube.com/ The Nomiki Show. I mispronounced Navalny today. Matt had to walk me through it beforehand, and I just can't get it. Did I say it just right then? Navalny?
Yep, I think that's right.
Oh, okay.
Also, right. He has a bad position on Black Lives Matter, so screw him.
Navalny does?
Well, Russia's a little bit. Russia makes parts of America look very, very progressive on race.
Yes, I would imagine. Jamie.
Hello.
What's happening on the Antifada this week?
I'm so glad you asked. Well, this week on the Antifada, I guess we made up for our little detour into neoliberalism last week because we had on our friends Jared Shanahan and Zana Kurti to talk about some of their work for the journal Hard Crackers, which was started by Noel Ignatieff, who was a great, great thinker who died last year. So we talked about their reporting on the George Floyd uprising and their reporting on the far right. And we had a really good far-ranging conversation with them. So that's coming out on Wednesday, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, still good, our episode from last week, wherein I go over the Obama book with Andre Dumise and Aaron Thorpe. And that was a pretty spicy episode as well.
You're going to get me to read that, and I have a feeling I'm going to resent it.
Well, we read it so you don't have to, Sam.
Yes, that's true, but I feel like compelled that I got to.
I mean, knock yourself out. It's horrible. It'll make Bezos, you feel bad.
The Obama one, the Bezos Amazon Press gives it away for free on Audible. So it's trying to get in people's minds, which is interesting.
Oh, my God. It's like that fucking U2 album that they put on all our phones. It's just like that. Part of my French. I'm very tired today. Same I forgot politics, I'm not supposed to swear.
Oh, they like automatically downloaded a like what was it 4 years ago or something like that with an iPhone update. Everyone got the U2.
Oh, I haven't updated my phone in like 4 or 5 years. I'm still using like I don't know.
It's like the I don't know if you guys
OIS
saw
like three. Or something.
Do you guys see that movie Pop Star? It's like the Lonely Island movie.
A great movie, yeah.
Really underrated comedy, and they have like a marketing scheme to get his album out there where they put it in like dishwashers, basically like GE. They pair up with it, so when you open the refrigerator, you hear his album, something like that.
Oh God, no! They're just gonna find a way to tattoo the Obama book on the insides of our eyelids, I think.
There's a song from Popstar called "Incredible Thoughts" that is sort of the Dave Rubin anthem. People should check it out.
Yeah. I love the other one where the Bin Laden song is pretty good, too.
Matt, what's happening on the Matt Leckian media universe?
So we did 3 hours last Thursday on Left Reckoning. Go check that out. It was fun. We have an interview with Milton Alamadi, and we talk about a lot of other stuff. But on Literary Hangover, episode 36 just dropped, The Secret Diary of William Byrd of Westover. We talk about the slave plantation owner / Indian trader who had some kind of descendants to George Washington and Robert E. Lee. We go through his secret diary that he recorded in code and then got revealed. And so there's a lot of interesting insight into the 1709 Virginia James River plantation milieu there. So check that out, patreon.com/literary hangover for that.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls and also endeavor to read your IMs. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Sent us this.
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner, please, son, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fucking reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. The alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.